Hello, this is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Baltimore on Q1370 WQLL. Catholic Baltimore is a weekly radio program hosted by the Archdiocese of Baltimore, airing each Sunday following the broadcast of the Radio Mass of Baltimore. We are grateful to our Catholic radio partners for sharing with us some of the contents in this program and for the opportunity to bring quality Catholic programming to the Archdiocese of Baltimore every Sunday.
We're here today on Catholic Baltimore with Jan Grafius. Jan is curator of collections for Stonyhurst College in London, England. We want to talk with her today a little bit about the college itself and its background, but also about some exciting relics that she's bringing to the United States as part of the upcoming Fortnight for Freedom, which runs June 21st through July 4th. Welcome, Jan.
Thank you. Welcome, too.
Well, I'd love to hear a little bit about the background of Stonyhurst College. I understand that it's had a very long history. It's one of the first colleges, English-speaking colleges in the world. Can you tell us about that?
That's right. We're actually the oldest surviving Jesuit college in the world now. We were founded in 1593 in the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. And in England at that time, because of the religious laws and the difficulties of the Reformation, our government had passed laws saying that it was illegal for Catholics to practice their faith or to educate their children in their faith in England. And so an English Jesuit called Robert Parsons got permission from King Philip of Spain to set up a school in Europe for English boys. And so in 1593, the school opened and 12 boys crossed the Channel and started school. One of them was our first saint, Thomas Garnet, who was executed in 1608 for his faith. And the school flourished and we're still going strong.
That would be really strange for boys to have to actually go to another part of the continent just to attend a religious school. I guess that was unusual at that time that they even had that option.
It was very unusual. I think in many ways it was an act of desperation because the government, the English government at that time, was trying to stifle Catholicism and hoping that by preventing children from being brought up in their faith, the faith would die out. And so parents were desperate, and they were willing to send their sons away for up to 6 years at a time and not see them. And the boys themselves had to change their names, they had to travel in disguise, and if they were captured, and there were government agents at every port in England watching out for these young boys crossing the Channel, if they were captured, they were taken away from their families, and their families were heavily fined and put in prison. So it was not a small thing at all. And, you know, these boys, some of them were as young as 10 years old, were crossing the Channel in the company with older boys, and would be away from home until they were 16, 17, or 18. And many of them then went on to study for the priesthood in Europe, and so perhaps wouldn't come home until they were in their 30s. So it was a huge undertaking for these young boys, and a great sacrifice for their parents.
Certainly nothing to be taken lightly, I guess, and that's a great testament to the parents and to the boys themselves to say that they really wanted to study this and to keep their Catholic faith alive. When they came back to England, what kind of reaction did they receive when they returned to England?
The mindset of what it was like to be Catholic in England in the 17th century, because, you know, for us in the 21st century, we have complete freedom to worship. It's a huge luxury, and I don't think we quite understand how precious that is. So the laws were very quickly passed. Once our school was founded, the Elizabethan government outlawed any parent sending their son across the seas to be educated in popery. That was the wording of the law. Mm-hmm. So from their very act of sending their sons to our school, they were breaking the law. The children were not allowed to inherit their parents' property. So for a son to go across the seas to be educated at our school automatically disinherited him. When he returned home at the age of 18 or 19, the law said he had 30 days to go to his nearest authority and to forswear his Catholicism, to accept the religious settlement at the time, or he would be put in prison. So, you know, even when the children had their education, they couldn't come home and live a normal life. And the penalties, the financial penalties, were absolutely huge. It was very, very difficult for many Catholic families to keep the roof over their head and to survive because of the financial penalties for practicing their faith.
That's just mind-boggling. When we think today about how difficult it might be to have to travel by bus to a school, and the witness of these young men and their families in making sure that they had an education that was solid and grounded in the faith, it's just kind of mind-boggling. I think for folks here, it would be very foreign to think about that.
It is, and I think we also forget. I work in a Jesuit college, and I teach lots of young people. And when you explain that this was what it was like in their own country 400 years ago, they find it hard to take. But you could be put in prison for practicing your faith. If you sheltered a priest in your house, you could be executed, and many people were. If you converted to Catholicism, you suffered the death penalty. If you converted someone else to Catholicism, you could suffer the death penalty. These are really powerful, punishments. And it's hard to believe that in a country which we now regard as, a bastion of freedom and democracy, that these things were the law. But so it was.
And I understand that from those people, there are saints and blesseds and martyrs among those who were executed for the things that you're talking about.
Yes, 22 of our pupils between 1608 and 1680 suffered the ultimate penalty. So we have 3 canonized saints from amongst our school pupils and 12 beatified martyrs and a further 7 venerable martyrs. And these were all young boys who went to our school who then became priests, most of them Jesuits, but some were secular priests, some were Franciscans, who came back to England in contravention of the law, were captured, mostly tortured, and executed. And it's something that the school is very proud of, naturally.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand also that the school has kind of been through a few different locations, but that it was at St. Omer's, France for a while, and that school community has a connection to our own first Archbishop John Carroll. Is that correct?
Indeed. Yes, that's correct. The school was founded it's a little town called Saint-Omer, it's near Calais, and in 1593 it wasn't in France, it was part of the Spanish Netherlands.
Okay.
So we were under the protection of Philip of Spain, and then with the religious laws and wars of the time, that part of the territory became French territory. So the school was in Saint-Omer from 1593 until 1762. And in 1748, 2 young gentlemen from Maryland arrived. That was John Carroll and his cousin Charles Carroll, who was the only Catholic signatory of the Declaration of Independence. John was 12 and Charlie was 10, and they crossed the Atlantic alone.
My goodness. Very impressive. Oh, my. That's just...
Can you imagine waving your children off at the port in America and not knowing, for months that they've actually got there safely?
No, it's not like you could pick up the phone and say, oh, we got here fine. It's okay. We're
fine.
That's phenomenal.
Texting.
That's phenomenal. That's good.
So John Carroll spent, I think, 8 years at our college, and then he became a Jesuit, and he actually was a teacher. So he went off and did his priestly training, and then he came back to the school to teach theology and classics. And Charlie studied at the school until he was 16, and then he went on to Paris, and then he went to London to study law. And then when the American Revolution broke out, he obviously came back and played a part in that, as did John Carroll.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie Carroll wrote some poems while he was at our school, which we have in our archives. And they're poems about freedom of conscience and liberty. And they're very powerful. They're written in Latin, beautiful classical Latin. And they're all exploring the themes of the penalties of following your faith. And I think that this is something, this education he had as a young man, formed him and John Carroll for when they went back to America to forge their own independent nation. They'd learned enough about freedom of conscience and also about persecution. That school was still a school under penalty. Mm-hmm. And they learned enough about independence and persecution to inform their activities as adults.
It's an amazing witness to the faith that if we realize that doesn't just happen today, but it really goes back centuries at this point to people who who learned that from an early age, from the age of 10 and 12, as you say, that they started having this embedded in themselves. That's wonderful.
And we're part of a community, so all the boys in their class and in their year groups and in the college had the same background. The Carrolls had left Ireland to go to America to escape persecution, and then in Baltimore in the 17th, 18th century, there were religious laws that came in that, again, made them have to travel to France for their education. So the Carrolls and many other American families, there are about 30 boys who came from Maryland and from America to study at our school. So it was a little community within the English community.
That's great. Well, we're talking today with Jan Grafius. Jan is the curator of collections at Stonyhurst College. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk about some relics that she's going to be bringing to the United States for the Fortnight for Freedom. This is Catholic Baltimore, and I'm Christopher Gunty.
Catholic news from the Archdiocese of Baltimore and around the world with the Catholic Review. Deacon Michael Rubeling, who is to be ordained to the priesthood for the Archdiocese of Baltimore on June 25th, requests your prayers as he readies to make this leap of faith. First feeling the call at age 8, Deacon Rubeling grew up in Frederick as the eldest of 10 siblings, participating in a full Catholic life centered around his home parish of St. Peter the Apostle in Liberty Town. After homeschooling through high school, Deacon Rubeling was halfway through his first year at Frederick Community College when he received what he says was a calling to enter priestly formation. "It was the closest thing I have ever heard of to God audibly speaking to me," Deacon Rubeling said. Read the whole story at CatholicReview.org or be at the cathedral June 25th at 10 a.m. to congratulate him in person when he becomes Father Rubeling. Congratulations are also in order for 2,298 young women and men across the Archdiocese who have graduated from our Catholic high schools. Get the details on baccalaureate masses and commencement exercises, as well as a few up-close and personal conversations with some of our standout grads in the next print edition of the Catholic Review. While we're still on the topic of congratulations in the Catholic Review, we can't help but pat ourselves on the back for winning 24 awards from regional, national, and international press associations for our coverage and products for web and print during 2015. We will redouble our efforts to bring you the highest quality and most relevant news coverage and feature stories through 2016 and beyond. From the newsroom of the Catholic Review, this is Eric Zygmunt.
Do you want to know more about what's going on in the church and the world than you can get from your daily newspaper or local TV? Read the only publication in the Archdiocese of Baltimore that covers the church full-time, the Catholic Review. Pick up the print magazine monthly at your parish or have the Catholic Review delivered to your home every month. You can get fresh news every day online at CatholicReview.org. Subscribe to the Catholic Review e-newsletter for twice-a-week updates. Just text CR Media to 84576. Find our app on Apple and Android, and follow the Catholic Review on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Wherever your faith takes you, Catholic Review Media is ready to inspire, teach, inform, and engage. Read it today, in print and online, at CatholicReview.org. That's CatholicReview.org.
You are listening to Catholic Baltimore on Q1370 WQLL.
Welcome back to Catholic Baltimore. This is Christopher Gunty of the Catholic Review, and I'm talking today with Jan Grafius, curator of collections at Stonyhurst College. Jan, I understand that you're going to be bringing with you some relics of two very important saints for the start of the Fortnight for Freedom here in the United States. Tell us about those relics.
Yes, that's correct. I'm very excited about it. At Stonyhurst, we have an incredibly large collection of relics of the of English saints, which were rescued during the Reformation from destruction, and we hold them in trust on behalf of English Catholics, and it's wonderful to be able to bring them to America for their message to reach a wider audience. So what I'm bringing is a signet ring that belonged to St. John Fisher, and a piece of bone and a tooth or St. Thomas More.
What's the significance of these saints, and what's the significance of having a relic of a saint like that here in our presence?
John Fisher and Thomas More, as I'm sure many of your listeners will know, were both servants and courtiers at the court of King Henry VIII in the early 16th century. And they had to face a very important decision when Henry VIII decided he wanted to divorce his wife and then break with the Roman Catholic Church. They, as his servants, as government servants, were expected to go along with his wishes. And neither of them, in conscience, could do so. They both tried very hard to persuade Henry to change his course, and then they both basically drew a line in the sand and said, we cannot cross this line. Our consciences will not allow us to forswear our faith and to say what we don't believe in. And they paid the ultimate penalty. They were both beheaded in 1535 and were regarded almost, you know, within hours and days of their death, they were regarded as martyrs and as men of conscience and great saintliness. And I think their relics are important because relics are very tangible reminders of the humanity of people. You know, we have a number of relics at the college, pieces of bone or cloth or books or objects that belong to saints. And when you look at these things, it draws you right back into their own time. It takes you very close to these people. And it's a connection. It's like a bridge that takes you through history to connect with these people. And it's much easier, I find, to imagine yourself back in the 16th century when you hold these things and look at them. And I hope that that's the experience that that the people of America will have when these things are brought over to Baltimore and to America next month.
It certainly will be an unusual experience. Not that we've never seen relics or been in the presence of a reliquary, but I think to understand that these are saints who, as Thomas More said, he was the king's good servant, but he was God's servant first. And so from that perspective, to know that there are men who were brave and bold when it cost them the most, and to be in the presence of relics of saints like that, I think will be especially uplifting and inspiring for our people. I wonder, it must not be very easy to travel with some such things. I guess you don't just tuck it in your carry-on bag and let it pass through security. What's that process like?
It's very complicated. When you travel as a museum curator, when you travel with any object, obviously there are laws to observe, government export licenses, and you have to make sure that that you can claim ownership so that when you travel abroad, other countries don't say, well, actually that was ours originally and then you took it from us, 300 years ago. You have to make very clear and sure that you have proper ownership and that all the government obligations are followed. When you're importing human remains, there's a whole other level of bureaucracy. I brought a relic of St. Thomas of Hereford to Boston a number of years ago and was slightly surprised when I came into Boston to be asked, was the person whose leg you're carrying, was he the victim of a crime? Can you prove that he wasn't, killed as part of a crime? And I said, well, he died in the 12th century.
Yes. I think that's outside of your jurisdiction.
It is, but of course, if you Thomas More, if anyone stops me at an American airport in a couple of weeks' time, how did Thomas More die? Well, his head was cut off. I mean, that counts as a crime, I think, with most people.
Yes.
But joking aside, you have to be absolutely sure that there is proper procedure and these things are properly registered and that each government is happy for it to leave our shores and that your government is happy for these things to enter and that they're recorded as entering and then they're recorded as leaving. They're very important cultural patrimony, and you have to treat them as if they're the crown jewels, in effect.
Yes, and I guess the provenance is very important, because if you're able to say, I preserved this chain, and so coming back, I know it's the same item that left, that's an important part to be part of your collection of relics.
Yes, and then the piece of Thomas More's bone, actually, when his head was cut off, it was stuck on a spike on London Bridge. That was what happened to traitors, as an example. And his daughter Meg, his beloved daughter Meg, bribed the watchman on the bridge and was given the head. And so this is a piece of Thomas More's jaw that Margaret Roper gave to her little brother and it was through the John Moore's family that the bone came to the college. So the provenance is absolutely passed on.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it's wonderful. You know, you might think it's a little gruesome to have a piece of bone in a little crystal reliquary, but when I look at it, I think of Meg wanting to rescue her father's head from this degradation and looking after it, and then sharing out these tiny pieces of her father to people who were close to her, and they kept them safely, through hundreds of years of persecution. So these are very powerful witnesses.
What do saints like Thomas More and John Fisher have to say for us today? I mean, our circumstances are not the way they were then. We're not necessarily being here in the United States. People's heads aren't being cut off for their witness to the faith. That is happening in other parts of the world. We know that to be happening. But for us in America, what's the connection? How do we understand really the importance of these men?
The importance of these men and the women and the men of the past who stood up for their faith and who stood up for what they believed in is it says to every single one of us, you have to know what you believe. You have to be able to justify to yourself that this is my faith, this is what I believe, this is important to me. And there will come a time in everybody's life when you'll be asked to stand up and be counted. And I say this to the children at the college here. You pay a price for your faith and for your beliefs. And it may be that the price is that you're being ridiculed by your friends who laugh at you for being a Christian or for being a Catholic. It may be that there's some mild persecution, some discrimination. It may be that it's more serious than that. When you go abroad or travel to other parts of the world, there is active persecution. And hopefully, most people... won't be asked to pay the sort of price that John Fisher and Thomas More did. But there is a price to pay, and you have to know what you believe in and be prepared to stand up for it. And I think that's the witness that these relics give to us. They inspire us with the faith of these strong men, and they say to us also, you too can be part of this strength by saying, I believe this, I hold this dear, and I will protect these values.
I recall a visit that I took to Malaysia one time to visit people who are in Catholic publishing there, and they made the point that in the predominantly Muslim country, for someone to be Catholic or Christian needed to be a brave stand. For someone to convert to Catholicism was an even bolder stand because they would be cut out of any chance to go to university or have jobs. And so it seems that, as you say, if we know what we believe, and we know that to be true, to witness to that faith always has a price and always can be cost us something. And for some, it cost them everything. But as you say, his daughter Meg carries on that tradition and was able to be a witness to that for others. And it's a very powerful message for us to bring as we start celebrating this Fortnight for Freedom and as we get ready to celebrate our Independence Day. We thank you so much for being with us, Jan. We've been talking with Jan Grafius. Jan is the curator of collections at Stonyhurst College in the north of England, and we're so glad to have her with us to talk about the Fortnight for Freedom and the relics that she's going to be bringing to the United States of St. Thomas More and St. John Fisher. We look forward to seeing you when you get to Baltimore.
I can't wait to come. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for being with us.
You're invited to the National Opening Mass of the Fortnight for Freedom, Tuesday, June 21st at 7 p.m. at the Basilica of the Assumption in downtown Baltimore. This Mass will be celebrated by Archbishop William E. Laurie and begins a 14-day period when Catholics and others can pray, reflect, and act to promote this first most cherished freedom. For more information, visit www.archbalt.org. May God bless you, and may God bless America.
The season of sacraments is nearly here. First Holy Communion, Confirmation, and Weddings. Visit the Baltimore Basilica, America's first cathedral, and stop by the gift shop for all of your gift needs. From beautiful frames to crucifixes and crosses, statues, and one-of-a-kind rosaries, the Basilica gift shop has it all. Friendly, knowledgeable staff members can help you select the perfect gift. Also available, Baltimore's very own Mouth Party Caramels, locally designed hand-painted signs, and jewelry, plus gifts for Easter, as well as an extensive line of St. Patrick's Day items, sure to bring out the Irish in everyone. Visit the Basilica Gift Shop at 409 Cathedral Street in Baltimore, or call 410-727-3565 for hours and directions. Free street parking available directly in front of the Basilica between 9:30 and 4 p.m.
For over 200 years, the Archdiocese of Baltimore's Catholic schools have welcomed families of all faiths, providing generations of students with an academically excellent, value-based education taught in a Christ-centered environment. With a 99% graduation rate, the highest in the nation, and a 98% college attendance rate, Catholic school graduates are better prepared to succeed in college and beyond. But Catholic schools offer more than an education. They offer tradition, family, faith, and the opportunity for students to grow as individuals and as future leaders in their community. Discover these and other benefits of a Catholic school and learn more about why Catholic schools are an unparalleled value in education in the Baltimore region. Call 1-800-5-CATHOLIC or visit www.archbalt.org. Catholic schools, a place to grow.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Catholic Baltimore. As we prepare for the week ahead, let us do so in prayer together as one community of faith. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Let us also ask the blessing and intercession of our Blessed Mother as we pray. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. May God bless us and keep us always in his love.